It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. President Obama delivered a speech on the economy today. He spoke in Galesburg, Illinois at Knox College, kicking off a series of economic speeches he'll be giving around the country.
In his speech, the president vowed to help the middle class.
The only thing I care about is how to use every minute of the remaining 1,276 days of my term to make this country work for working Americans again.
Little bit of Obama's speech there. And first, we'll get a reaction to the speech from Brian Schimming, the vice chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me.
So in President Obama's words, we're not there yet. That's Obama referring to the economy. What do you make of that?
Well, he's certainly right on that. With all possible respect to the president, we've been here before. I mean, all the talk here the last 24 hours about how the president was going to pivot to the economy. Well, some industrious reporter counted up last night or this morning and said they'd had 17 different pivots to the economy over the president's less than 5 years in office. So he was referring to it as Deja Pivot. And I think there's a lot to that. Look, it seems to me here, with all possible respect to the president, it seems to me here he's got a couple problems. That, number one, he wins re-election last November, and his numbers have gone down from that ever since. You've got a scandal-plagued White House with the Benghazi cover-up, with NSA, with the IRS targeting of conservative groups, spying on reporters. So you've got that whole thing.
Now, Obama, of course, referred to that stuff in the speech as distractions when he was chiding Congress. What's your response to that?
Well, the president may think it's a distraction, but the public doesn't think it's a distraction. You've got the public who wants special prosecutors looking at both Benghazi and the IRS thing. So he may consider it a distraction, but the people don't consider it a distraction. Actually, not at all. So that's number one. Secondly, you've got Obamacare, and they've had 10 different delays or major problems with Obamacare. Of course, as you know, the most recent, the employer mandate, the delay on the employer mandate, the signature achievement, if you want to call it that, of this administration is still upside down in the polling after the president assured his own party, in fact, they lost control of the House on this issue, that those numbers would turn around. So you've got that issue. And then, of course, the economy itself now still at 7.6% unemployment. Interestingly, the latest report, 195,000 people picking up jobs, which in a regular economy you might say, well, gosh, that sounds like a pretty good number. But it's not enough to keep up. We've lost 8.7 million jobs during this recession, and the real unemployment rate, of course, which is unemployed, underemployed, and people who've fallen out of the economy because they just gave up, is 14.3%. Well, those are three pretty big, major problems for the president. So I'm not surprised he's trying to pivot away from some of the other subjects because, frankly, he doesn't have a choice.
Well, some people are billing this as a move for President Obama to sort of get his legacy rolling a little bit. And the legacy for Obama, for better or worse, whatever happens during this tenure, will be the economy. He came in a major slump. Right now, there are some signs of improvement. You know, you say not as good as we'd like. There are signs that consumer confidence is on the rise. That's a positive. But do you think the speech today was Obama looking to his legacy?
I think there's some truth to that. Look, one of the things, I've spent a lot of time, as you may know, in Washington, and one of the things with any second-term president is they are looking to get the legacy issues stapled into place. But the president kind of, in some ways, he almost stapled his legacy into place in the first year and a half of the administration, because instead of dealing with the economy and with the unemployment problems and the housing crisis and all the things that we had in his first and second year, he focused his time on Obamacare, on getting Obamacare passed, which he did, and then his party took a terrible beating at the polls. Well, he's, in my view, anyway, my view would be, he's never recovered from that. I mean, dropping $1.7 trillion on stimulus. I mean, does anyone remember what the vice president called recovery summer? Well, we've been through several summers, fall, springs, and winters since then. We just haven't gotten there. So even if you can point to a warm up on a couple issues, the fact, the numerical fact, and I think facts matter here, is you've got 2.2 million people fewer people employed right now, and 1.6 million less in the private sector. That's a disaster. It's nothing for the president to crow about.
Now, as we've heard over and over, there is polarization in Washington. There is not bipartisan cooperation. And in this speech, the president called on Republicans to introduce their ideas to help get the American economy rolling, to aid in what he's seeing as hopeful signs for the economy. And again, he scolded Congress. He called them distracted. But can you tell us what plans Republicans have already released and how you think Republicans in Congress will react to his calling on them?
Well, my sense of that is that the president, that the Republicans will say, including Congressman Ryan from Wisconsin, will say, Mr. President, let's get to some spending controls, because that's the piece the president never wants to deal with. Let's get to some spending controls. Perhaps let's get to some tax cuts, which helped, you know, the best recovery we've ever had in the early 80s. Take hold while we're in the, you know, now we're in literally, if you can call it a recovery, the worst one since the Great Depression. It's a jobless recovery. So instead of consistently doing what the president says he wants to do, which is to pile more stimulus, pile more federal spending, I think the Republicans will come back and say, let's do some spending cuts, let's do some tax cuts instead, because that's what's worked before, including going back to John F. Kennedy. That seems to have worked before, and what the president's been doing plainly, now numerically, we know factually it is not working.
Now, so what would you like to see the president do to get the economy rolling?
Well, I think listening to some of the Republicans in the House would be helpful. I mean, the president put the stimulus and put the Obamacare package together without Republican input, and we now have seen how that works. I mean, both of those things he either relegated to Congress or did it without Republican input. And I think Speaker Boehner put it well this morning. Mr. President, welcome back to the job situation. Welcome back to that conversation. That's where we've been from the get-go. And so I think that one of the best things the president can do is invite the House Republicans down to the White House, but take them seriously, not just insist. I mean, look, one thing is a practical matter, speaking of his legacy, is that he's now a second-term president. Well, he probably, my best guess, and I think other people would say this too, who spent some time in D.C., maybe he's got 4, 5, 6 months, in essence, it left of his term, in terms of trying to get things done. It's not any easier, I guess, to get things done in an election year. And after next year's election, people are going to be focused on the next presidential race. So I think with respect to your discussion about legacy, the president doesn't have a lot of time left, and he should use it wisely.
Now, both parties have tried to lay claim to the middle class to say that they are the party of the middle class who's going to do the most to help get the middle class moving again. In his speech today, President Obama referred to income inequality and how it was morally wrong, it's bad economics, clearly, you know, referring there to getting the middle class involved again, getting them moving. What is your take on that?
My sense of that, I would say to the president, if he wants to get the middle class involved again, he should put the brakes on all of Obamacare. And the reason I say that is the numbers we've been seeing the last couple of months, but I guess one could argue the last several months, have shown we are now moving to a 28-hour-a-week economy. Because Obamacare requires, if you work more than 30 hours a week, requires all these employer mandates and all these employer taxes, and employers are reacting and taking full-time folks down to part-time. Well, that's punishing working people in this country. I talked to somebody here just a week ago who's had a 40-hour-a-week job, also is going to school, and employees at that company were called in and said, we can't afford to do this anymore. And just about everybody, by the way it sounded, got busted down to 28 hours. The president actually has put the exact wrong incentives into place to help working people. Obamacare is punishing working people in this country, young, old, middle-aged, more than anything the president has done, including stimulus. If he wanted to help working people in this country, if he wanted to help middle-class people in this country, he would freeze the Obamacare implementation.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Brian, but I thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate the invitation.
That was Brian Schimming, Vice Chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin.
Coming up next, we'll get another reaction to President Obama's speech on the economy. We'll have Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. President Obama gave his big economic speech today at Knox College in Illinois. He focused on how to help the economy for middle-class Americans.
Now, we just spoke with Brian Schimming of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, and now Matt Rothschild joins us. He's editor of the Progressive magazine. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Hi, Rob. Congrats on your new show.
Thank you. I'm loving it. Great. Thanks for being here. Well, I want to ask you, so the country's been mired in some recent debates. Gun control is one, race, immigration. Is now the right time to refocus on the economy for President Obama?
Well, I think it's the right time because it's the number one issue in people's minds, and it's a problem. I mean, we've had this high level of unemployment for way too long. President Obama gave a real good speech today. I mean, he was right to stress the problem of inequality in this country, and he stressed it as a moral issue. And as you mentioned a little bit earlier with Brian, also as an economic issue. But it should be bad enough that it's a moral issue and we should be able to address it on that ground alone. But if people don't have enough money in their pockets to spend, they're not going to be able to go out and buy products, and businesses aren't going to be able to hire employees. And that's really what's been happening over the last several years here. There's been a lack of enough stimulus, not too much stimulus, as Brian was suggesting in the last segment.
Now, we heard Brian suggesting that it wasn't really Washington that took its eye off the ball. It was President Obama. He didn't stay on track. He himself was distracted that he let himself let go of the economy. What's your take on that?
Well, every time you propose something in the last 5.5, 6 years, the Republicans have been doing everything in their power to stop him in his tracks. That's why I liked President Obama's talk this day when he talked about the slash and burn partisanship and Congress careening from crisis to crisis. I mean, it has been hyperpartisan. I mean, you had leaders of the Republican Party in Congress saying our number one job is to defeat President Obama. They weren't successful, and now they just want to make his second term as abysmal as possible. So I think he was right to call out Congress. He was also right to say that he's going to do whatever he can on his own to get this economy cooking again.
Now, some analysts have said that this speech is an attempt to jumpstart the Obama legacy, which will likely be about the economy, whether or not he's able to turn it around. We've seen some signs that the Obama administration is pointing to, among them a rise in consumer confidence, falling unemployment rate. Do you think this speech is purely about the economy, or do you think that Obama's starting to work on this legacy seriously?
Well, he may be working on his legacy. I think part of his economic legacy will be that the economy didn't go over the cliff into a Great Depression, which is where it was headed when Bush got out of office, thanks to all the shenanigans by the banks. And so I think Obama is correct to focus on the economy, though, because the high level of unemployment will be a negative mark, whereas, you know, keeping us from falling into a Great Depression will be a positive mark. But what I liked especially about Obama's speech today, he wasn't content to cite the statistics about the economy actually getting better, which it has, frankly, it has over the last year and a half. He said, if we just do that, if we just keep on going, doing what we're doing, you know, things may gradually get even a little better because there's all this pent up demand in the economy and things are going in the right direction. But that wouldn't be enough. It wouldn't be enough because we wouldn't have gotten at the problem of the lack of mobility. Upward mobility in this country. And also we wouldn't be getting at the money power. And it was refreshing to hear the president of the United States talk about money's power, not only over the economy, but money's power over the political system.
Now, President Obama has indicated that he's willing to use every executive power available to help the middle class. And again, Republicans and Democrats have been sort of fighting over this territory about who really lays claim to the middle class. But do you anticipate him using any of these executive powers in the rest of his term?
Yeah, I think he'll do whatever he can to get the economy going, you know, to boost hiring, maybe to boost union hiring in the executive branch, which would help. I wish he talked a little bit more about unions. He did talk about unions not having as much power as they used to. He didn't explain why, and the answer to that is obvious, because corporations have been breaking the labor laws of this country flagrantly by firing labor organizers and threatening to lay off people if people sign a union card, which is against the labor laws of this country, too. But I think he understands the importance of unions, and maybe he'll help the federal sector in its purchasing power purchase from unionized companies, which would be a good thing.
Now, as far as bipartisanship, you know, this has been an incredibly polarized Congress, and President Obama today called on Republicans to submit their ideas to help the economy, to get everybody involved. Do you think Obama and Congress, are they ready to work together, Republicans and President Obama?
No, I don't see them working together on almost anything, with the possible exception of immigration, but people in the House don't want to even do that on the Republican side. So this partisanship, this slash and burn partisanship that President Obama noted in his speech is likely to persist. And it is a serious problem. And I think Republicans want nothing more than the economy to do badly so long as President Obama's in power. And how callous is that? I mean, we've got 10 million people about unemployed in this country. We have wages that have stagnated, and they're content with that.
Well, in this speech, the president announced an economic initiative based on jobs. He mentioned education, home ownership, retirement, and health care. How do you see this plan playing out in Congress?
Well, I think health care, as he calls it, Obamacare. I wish he'd stop calling it Obamacare. I'd rather have him call it the Affordable Care Act, which is what it is. I know your last guest from the Republican Party of Wisconsin said he should stop Obamacare in its tracks. Well, that would be a disaster for millions and millions of Americans who are counting on the Affordable Care Act to give them health insurance if they've got a pre-existing condition. And what's going to happen to those people if the Affordable Care Act gets stopped in its tracks? I don't think the Republicans are going to succeed there. I think on some other issues, you know, generating jobs, I think the Republicans are going to get in the way of his jobs program, just as they have in the past, and some of his education plans, too. So I think he doesn't have as much power passing things through Congress as he does just using whatever powers he has at his disposal as head of the executive branch.
Now, in terms of whether or not the American people should be optimistic, there are a couple of good indicators that the economy is improving. Again, though, we have the 7.6% unemployment rate, which is pretty high. Brian Schimming called this recovery. He kind of said, if you can call it that, it's the worst recovery since the Great Depression. What is your sense about whether or not things are truly trending upward?
I think things are trending upward, but it has been essentially a jobless recovery. I mean, we had unemployment that was was around 10% at its worst point. Now it's only down to the mid-sevens, and that's bad, historically bad. One of the reasons it's bad is because the Republicans in Congress resisted every single jobs program that the president put forward. And also, to be fair, the president did not put forward a big enough stimulus in the first place when he had a lot of power in those first 6 months. He should have doubled the amount of stimulus.
Why didn't he?
I think he was worried about the $1 trillion price tag on it, and that would scare a lot of people away.
Well, so we've got these 2014 elections creeping up a little bit. Do you think that Congress is going to stall until we see the outcome of these elections, or to influence the outcomes of elections in terms of working together?
I don't bet on Congress doing anything. So I think the safest bet is to say Congress is going to do nothing.
All right. So if you're a betting man, you're saying not much is going to happen.
I don't think so. I think the president will get some things done by himself, but not that much through Congress. I don't see a new jobs program going through. A federal jobs program is what we really needed. He didn't even propose that today. That would have been a real progressive solution along the lines that FDR proposed back in the 30s, but we're not there yet.
So in about 30 seconds left, in these 2014 elections, you can imagine Republicans saying, you know, the economy is not where it should be. It's the worst recovery that we've seen. And the Obama administration saying things are looking up. Who do you think is going to get the voting public on its side?
Well, if unemployment goes down under 7%, I think the Democrats will do real well. I'm not sure it's going to get under 7%, and then they'll just be the blame game. And I think a lot of the American public, including me, tired of the blame game.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming to the studio today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That was Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to a psychologist about rejection. It turns out, of all things, Tylenol can help reduce some of the emotional pain of being rejected. And our guest is going to tell us why and clue us into some other surprising facts about rejection.
And we'll talk to a doctor who specializes in obesity about the body mass index, more commonly known as the BMI. That's come under a lot of fire recently. We'll find out why and whether it's still useful.
And we'll also talk about why historically black colleges are in peril.
There's all that coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 4, we'll take a look at new efforts to resolve unsolved murders in Wisconsin as part of our continuing coverage.
Now, our next guest has been covering law enforcement for quite a while now, first for Reason Magazine and now for the Huffington Post. He says there's a long-term trend we should be worried about, the growing use of military-style weapons and tactics by police.
You can join in now with your questions and comments. Is this something that worries you? Do you think it's necessary for law enforcement agencies to have these tools at their disposal? If you're in law enforcement, what do you think? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org.
Our guest is Radley Balco. He's author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Radley, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
The most dramatic stories you tell in your book are about police raids. One that caught the attention of the American public was that raid in Columbia, Missouri. It was back in 2010. The police video was released, I think, after an open records request. It went viral, and it got a lot of attention. Tell us what happened.
Sure. So this was in Columbia, Missouri, where actually marijuana had been decriminalized. But the police got a tip this guy, Jonathan Whitworth, was there was some sort of drug activity going on at his house. They did what they call a trash pull, where they can go through your garbage without a warrant. They found some seeds and residue, and it was basically based on that evidence that they conducted a nighttime raid on this house. And in the video, you see, they knock and announce themselves, and seconds later, they take down the door of the battering ram. Within seconds of entering the house, you hear gunshots. That's them killing one of the dogs and actually mistakenly shooting the other one. Eventually they get to Whitworth himself. He's brought out, pushed to the ground at gunpoint, handcuffed. You see his 8-year-old son ushered out of the house. The police had no idea, actually, that there was a child in the house at the time. There are bullets flying around, hitting targets that weren't intended. There's a child in the house they weren't aware of. They found a small amount of marijuana, but under Columbia, Columbia's decriminalization, they actually couldn't charge him with a crime. They did find a pipe near that marijuana, so they charged him with drug paraphernalia, but I believe it was about a $300 fine. But that was what they found. And so when this raid, went viral online, the reaction was pretty astounding. I mean, people were really angry at what they saw in this video. The Columbia Police Department got, their phone lines went down, their email went down, they got death threats. There was actually nothing really all that unusual about that raid other than the fact that it had been recorded and posted online. But everything else was fairly standard. I mean, the killing of the dog is pretty standard in a lot of these raids. The fact that it was based on a tip and a trash pull and little else, the fact that it was done at night, all these things were pretty standard and, in fact, are common to the 100 to 150 similar raids that are done every day in this country. And so as somebody who had been covering this for a while, it was interesting for me to see the reaction. It was almost as if a new generation of, the Internet generation, basically, for the first time was seeing how the drug war is actually fought on the ground and how warlike it actually has become. And they were pretty, angry by what they saw, which I thought was an interesting reaction.
And these raids, they're done by SWAT teams or an equivalent thereof. They're in military-looking uniforms. I watched as much of that video as I could stand to watch. They're armed to the teeth, like some pretty heavy weapons. Talk about the growth of SWAT teams around the country.
Yeah, so there's a criminologist at at Eastern Kentucky University who, in the late '90s, sent surveys out to police departments across the country and asked them if they had a SWAT team, how often they used it, and then he asked them to go back to the early 1980s and talk about, you know, when they got their SWAT team and, you know, how often they used it over the years. And what he found was pretty striking. You know, in the 70s, there were about a few hundred SWAT raids per year across the entire country. By the early 80s, we were up to about 3,000. And by 2005, when Kraska did a follow-up survey, he estimated we were up to about 50,000 SWAT raids per year. That's a pretty massive increase. And he also found that the vast majority of that increase was due to the use of SWAT teams to serve warrants on people suspected of drug crimes. And so, the shift that we've seen then is from, the use of SWAT teams as a last resort in emergency-type situations where you have someone who presents an immediate threat to other people. So, you know, if you think bank robberies or active shooters or, hostage takings, that sort of thing. And there, you know, the police are using violence to defuse an already violent situation in order to save lives. The problem with, the overwhelming use of SWAT teams today is they're used to serve these drug warrants, and here they're creating violence and confrontation where there was none before. And that's really, you know, where I think a lot of the objections to these tactics lie.
From the police point of view, though, you know, about 150 police officers die in the line of duty each year, about a third of them from gunshot wounds, according to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Aren't they just saying, hey, we want to go in, protect ourselves as well as possible in what could potentially be a hostile situation?
Yeah, well, I mean, first, those statistics, you know, obviously every, you know, death is a tragedy, every homicide is a tragedy, but, you know, those are pretty low numbers. Last year was actually the safest year for police officers. The second safest year for police officers since the early 1960s. I think 2009 was the safest. And, you know, some of those shootings of police officers were actually, you know, during traffic stops. I mean, they weren't, officers who were killed serving warrants. I interviewed a lot of police officers for this book, and particularly some of the older officers who are concerned about these trends, they say that even drug dealers know that if you shoot and kill a police officer, you know, you're going to be lucky to survive the next few seconds. But, you know, if you do, you're going to be going to jail for the rest of your life, and you're probably going to be executed if you're in a death penalty state. I think there's a good case to be made that even when drug dealers shoot at police in these raids, they think they're shooting at other drug dealers who have, you know, come to rip them off. I think these tactics, you know, when you break into a house in the middle of the night, you elicit a very primal response in people, whether it is, you know, the drug dealer you're after or you get the wrong house and it's a, you know, an innocent family. You invite confrontation and, you know, you put people in this position where they have to make a pretty, a profound decision. You know, they have to decide whether the people breaking into their house are police there, you know, executing a warrant or criminals who are there to do them harm. I think it's more dangerous for police officers, but also I just think it's, you know, these are consensual, you know, nonviolent crimes. They're drug crimes that are the vast majority of these raids, and that kind of force and that kind of violence, I think we need to have a debate over whether it's appropriate for those sorts of crimes.
Is this part of a wider overall mentality? I mean, we've been calling it the war on drugs for a long time. Are we getting a war mentality in our law enforcement?
I mean, I think there's a good case that we are. As you said, for a couple generations now, we've been telling police officers that they're fighting wars, wars on crime, war on drugs, war on terror. They're getting then armed like soldiers, they're dressing like soldiers, they're being trained in military tactics, and then they're sent out and told they're fighting a war. And that has an effect on a police officer's mindset and the way he interacts with the community. I also think, you know, we've seen some other more subtle changes in policing that have also kind of fostered this sort of us versus them mentality. Police officers used to walk beats a lot. We've shifted to police officers patrolling in squad cars. And if you think about what that does, you know, if the only time the police officer gets out of a squad car and interacts with the community is when there's something wrong, an altercation or somebody's, you know, acting suspiciously or he's been called to, you know, a scene of a crime, that fosters, a very antagonistic relationship with the community. It encourages the community to see the police officer as, you know, an antagonizing force. But also for the police officer, I mean, you know, if you can imagine having a job where your only interaction with other people during the day is negative and confrontational, that's going to, you know, have an impact on your sort of psychology and the way you approach your job, and it also probably makes for a pretty miserable job experience.
You say in your book that you're not writing this as an anti-police book. You don't actually blame the police officers involved here. Who do you see as being at fault? Who led us in this direction?
Well, yeah, I mean, to the extent, you know, in some of the anecdotes, there are police officers who are behaving poorly, and, you know, in those cases, obviously, they deserve some blame. But I think, you know, the larger problem, the blame lies with politicians. I mean, they're the ones who set the policies in motion that have gotten us here. And, you know, they're the ones really that have started the war rhetoric and the constant martial rhetoric that, you know, ends up filtering down to the average police officer on the street. And, you know, I mean, police militarization, it's happened over 30 years. It's the culmination of a number of different policies, from various federal anti-drug grants to, you know, equipment giveaways from the Pentagon to DHS grants to buy even more equipment. You know, there was never Congress never had a vote that said we're going to militarize police now. It's the culmination of a lot of policies, and it's a trend that's sort of developed over, you know, several decades. And because of that, there's never really been a public discussion about this. There's never really been, you know, a public debate about whether, you know, when the use of this kind of force is appropriate, and whether the way it's being used today is, you know, the sort of thing that we associate with a free society.
That's Radley Balko. He stays with us to talk about his new book, Rise of the Warrior Cop: The Militarization of America's Police Forces.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you feel as though America's police forces have been overly militarized, or is it necessary to deal with the problems that we see in cities and communities around the country? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
We'll continue our discussion now with Radley Balko about his new book, Rise of the Warrior Cop: The Militarization of America's Police Forces. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We have Mark on the line now. We'll go to the phones. Mark, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd first like to say I think that the police officers are not they don't have enough power or as in the tools that they need. With that said, this guy's right on. I'm a retired police officer, and I participated in a raid exactly like what he said, except there was no shooting involved, luckily. And all we found was just a little marijuana pipe, where we went through the garbage beforehand, or somebody did, and found a couple of seeds. Now, participating in this raid, all the police officers, including myself, or at least myself, I don't know how many, we did not know the circumstances of what this raid was. We just knew that this was a drug dealer, or we were told we were a drug dealer, and we're going in there. All blacked out, wearing masks, and fully automatic weapons. Later to find out, all they found was a couple of seeds in the garbage and, you know, very minor things, and we got this warrant to go in there.
Mark, I got to ask, how did it make you feel to go in there and find that out afterwards? You'd done this fully armed.
Afterwards, not very good at all. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm the typical person where when, you know, on a traffic stop and somebody had some, you know, either a little weed or a thing, I tell them, dump it out, smash the pipe, and away you go. Why ruin their, because now people can't get their college loans and stuff with even a little minor conviction. So you just let them go if they have something minor, you know?
Gotcha. Mark, I'll step in. And Radley, have you heard a lot of stories like Mark's?
Well, I did talk to a lot of police officers and you know, researching and reporting in the book. I will say that I think that the older officers that I talk to tend to be more concerned about what's going on than the younger officers. You know, they you know, remember a time when warrants were served by, you know, actually knocking on the door and waiting for somebody to let them in, even, you know, even against dangerous people. I mean, I tell a story in the book about a guy, an undercover cop who worked with the Hells Angels and built a methamphetamine case against them. And, you know, he said, you bring several uniformed officers to the door so they know that you're police. But the surprise tactics that they're using today, you know, he said that it encourages violence instead of sort of giving people the opportunity to surrender peacefully. I am sort of curious. The previous caller, you know, he mentioned this raid and that he sort of felt bad afterward, but he also began his call by saying that he thought police needed more of this sort of power, which is, I don't know, it's a sort of curious conclusion to have drawn from that.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Mark. I think he's off the line now. One thing that Mark did mention was, and as in the case we started off talking about, this ended up being a big military-style raid for just a little bit of marijuana. You also talk about other low-stakes things like you know, gambling and poker games getting these raids. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, well, this is something we've seen recently where I guess you could call it mission creep with these SWAT teams where, again, you have, you know, you have this team and so you have this hammer and all the problems, you know, start looking like nails to borrow from the old saying. And so, you know, when the Texas Hold'em craze started picking up in the mid-2000s, we see police departments reacting to it by sending SWAT teams out to raid these poker games. In the book, I've even reported on cases where SWAT teams are being sent out to enforce regulatory law, alcohol inspections at bars. In Connecticut a couple years ago, there was a SWAT team sent out to a bar where police suspected there was underage drinking going on. And then even kind of more disturbing than that is this idea of using regulatory law to get around the Fourth Amendment. So in Orlando a couple years ago, there was police suspected there was some drug activity going on at barbershops across the city, mostly minority-owned barbershops. And they actually didn't have enough evidence to get a search warrant, which, you know, it actually does not take a whole lot of evidence to get a search warrant. And so instead, what they did is they got somebody from the an inspector from the state occupational licensing board to go with them. And now they raided these barbershops under the guise of a licensure inspection, you know, to make sure that all these barbers were properly licensed to cut hair. But then you send these tactical teams in to perform the inspection, and, you know, it ends up being basically a drug search. And they arrested, you know, several dozen people, and I think all but three were arrested for barbering without a license. They did catch a few people with drugs. I think one was ended up facing felony charges. But, you know, again, this is, you know, seeing this with bars also, where if there's a bar where police suspect there's a lot of drug activity going on, they can just bring an alcohol inspector, and now this turns into, you know, officially it's an inspection to make sure, you know, all the bottles are labeled correctly and stored correctly, but it ends up basically being a SWAT raid where everybody gets sort of, you know, patted down and searched.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Susan in Madison on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
What do you think about this?
Well, I agree. I wish I had thought to write a book first. I had the experience recently, the last time Obama was here, just standing on a hill peacefully, enjoying the companionship with other Madison folks who came to see Obama speak. And the cops came through and treated us. I couldn't figure out what their behavior was for. I thought the only case that it would be appropriate in is if there was like a bomb threat or someone was dying. They screamed at us and yelled at us and treated us with total disrespect. Shoved us all to one side so that we were all crowded, could hardly move, and they cleared the sidewalk, and then nothing happened. They just insisted that we stand there penned like animals, barely able to move, so that they could clear this wide, wide path and then just stand there with their thumbs in their belts.
Thanks a lot for calling, Susan. And Radley, you write about another concern of yours in the book that some of these tactics and the militarized police are being turned against people protesting politically.
Yeah, that's right. It goes back to the 1999 WTO protest in Seattle and the particularly militaristic reaction that the Seattle Police Department used against those protesters. And actually, in the book, I interviewed the Seattle police chief at the time, Norm Stamper, who, you know, was in charge of that response. And, you know, today he calls it one of the biggest mistakes of his career because he said he's seen how police have reacted to protests since and that they've used Seattle as kind of a template. And so they respond now to protests expecting, you know, confrontation and, you know, putting on the, you know, the extra gear, kind of the RoboCop looking gear from the outset. And, you know, it used to be that, you know, I interviewed a former police chief in D.C., Jerry Wilson, and, you know, he said the way he would respond to protests, and this was during the 70s, you know, when there's a lot of civil unrest going on, is he would put, you know, regular police officers at the front, you know, guys in the traditional looking police blues, those would be sort of the front line people who were interacting with the protesters. He said, you know, you have to have the right cops ready to go in case something does happen. But he said he would put them on buses and park them off on a side street so that they were out of view. And his, you know, his reasoning for that was he said, if you send your cops into these protests expecting confrontation, then that's usually what you're going to get.
We'll go back to the phones now. Thanks for sharing your experience, Susan. We've got James in Northern Illinois now. Hi, James.
Hi. I guess my thing was that as a former drug dealer and a former drug user, I think that there's a profit motive on both sides to maintain the status quo, and that the drug dealers make money because the drugs are illegal and the police make money because they can get extra money from the government and the whole prison complex with building that up and putting people in jail for ridiculous quantities of harmless drugs. As long as the profit motive's there, you're never going to get rid of the problem. The battle will never be won.
Thanks for the call. Bradley, is there that budget incentive, I guess, for police departments to use these special weapons and tactics?
There is, and I talk about this in the book. Once all these departments had SWAT teams with a lot of equipment and gear that they were getting from the Pentagon, the federal government created these incentives to use them, and so there are these grants that go strictly for anti-drug policing. Now you have your SWAT team, and you could keep it in reserve and wait for, one of these emergency-type situations that, SWAT teams were originally created for. And in a lot of the small towns, that's just never going to happen. Or you could start sending them out on drug raids, and now there's federal money tied to those raids. Also, there's asset forfeiture policies, which, if you can keep any property you find on the raid that can, even loosely be connected to a crime. And now, sending your SWAT team out after drug offenders can generate revenue for the police department. So there are these strong financial incentives, I think, to use these ultra-aggressive tactics to serve drug warrants.
You've been trying to bring attention to these issues for a long time. Do you see efforts out there from officials to reform this?
A little bit. I don't think so far I haven't really talked to any, politicians, congressmen, mayors who are, willing to make this an issue. I will say, though, that I think the public perception of this issue is changing. I think people are much more willing to question these tactics now and ask if this is an appropriate use of force. If you read, for example, the comment responses to newspaper articles about these raids, they're much more skeptical of police, I think, than they were when I started covering this issue. So I think the public is starting to ask some questions. I think Congress usually lags, a decade or so behind public opinion. But, I have gotten some positive responses from some police officials across the country that, they have sort of felt this way, too. But, that it's not really to a point where they're comfortable speaking out about it.
We'll leave it there and maybe follow this issue with you in the future. Radley, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Radley Balko, author of Rise of the Warrior Cop. It's his new book about the militarization of America's police forces.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and news is coming up next on Central Time. And don't forget, you can leave your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what you think about this discussion about the militarization of America.